History is the news that's worth remembering. Out of the news of this week, you'll remember a new role in the Congo for the United Nations, the meaning of Dag Hammarskjöld's new mandate, and what he's up against in trying to carry it out. Your correspondent, Walter Cronkite. Leopoldville, the Congo. Here in the Cité, the native quarter, the tremors of civil war lie close to the surface, muffled in daylight by patrols of native police and by the overpowering heat of the tropical summer. It's after dark that the conflicts erupt. Rival gangs range these same streets and alleyways, attacking each other with knives and bicycle chains in the name of their rival tribes and the names of their leaders, Kasavubu, Mobutu, Kizenga, and the dead Lumumba. To put down this threat of civil war, which lies just below the surface, this was the burden the United Nations shouldered this week. For months now, the UN's role in the Congo has been mainly passive, to stand by in hopes of discouraging the outbursts of force. The latest resolution instructs Secretary General Hammarskjöld to take an active role, to step in with force if necessary. And the first test of that force is shaping up tonight. A column of 1,000 United Nations troops is on the march into Kasai Province. Their orders are to stop a reported move by troops of Soviet-backed Antoine Gizenga. The UN must try to prevent fighting between these two Congolese forces, using arms, if necessary, under the terms of this new mandate. And it's an encouraging mandate. It cools off, for the time being at least, the threat of action by the big powers themselves, the threat of a jungle cold war. But it's a tough mandate to execute. Hammarskjöld is being asked to act in the face of resistance from all sides, among the Congolese themselves, in the face of lingering Belgian influence, which has stiffened that resistance, in the face of troop withdrawals, too, which have reduced his already weak UN forces, and in the face of Soviet harassment, which is still going on. At the UN today, the Russians have been prodding Mr. Hammarskjöld to get on with the business of clearing the Belgians out. The Belgians who, they claim, are the mainstay of the pro-Western elements in Congo politics. Well, with the strange names of the people and the places involved, the chef stirring in the Congo stew had better keep his cookbook in front of him if he's not to confuse the ingredients. Here, roughly, is one-fourth of the nation in the West, most of the two provinces of Equator and Leopoldville. And here in the capital of Leopoldville is the government that we recognize. Its leaders, Joseph Kasavubu, president, Joseph Ileo, premier, and strongman army chief Joseph Mobutu. Here is the greatest threat to the Congolese peace represented by this nation. This is the threat. These are the eastern provinces of Oriental and Kivu. From their capital of Stanleyville, there reigns the gentleman Antoine Gizenga. He claims to be Lumumba's successor, and his regime has been recognized as the Congo's legal government by most of the communist nations and by Nasser's United Arab Republic. But today's news says that Gizenga himself is being threatened by other presumably communist splinter groups, and that may force Gizenga to try to get together a rapprochement with some of the other forces in the Congo. The third main force in the Congo are those with strong ties to the old Belgian government. Here is the splinter state of Kasai. It's a rich mining area presided over by Albert Kolongi. He split off when Congo disintegration began. Tonight, there are reports that some of Gizenga's rebel forces are moving into Kasai province, but no confirmation on that as yet. Kolongi may someday get together with the largest of the pro-Belgian stronghold forces, that in the province of Katanga. Here rules Mosi Chombi, who the communists claim is a stooge of former colonialists. Chombi's capital is Elizabethville. His comparatively rich province perhaps is the only fully self-sustaining one in the Congo. Any Belgian hope of maintaining a toehold in Africa and of salvaging something from the huge investment in the Katanga mines rests with Chombi. Any hope of a solution to the Congo crisis seems to depend on loosening the Belgians' grip. The army of the self-proclaimed Republic of Katanga, perhaps 5,000 men loyal to their self-proclaimed president, Mosi Chombi. With Belgian help, Chombi has maintained this force, probably the strongest and best disciplined of all the rival armies in the Congo. Belgian staff officers, Belgian military advisors. And in the politics of Katanga, Belgian administrators are highly influential. The Belgians never left Katanga. The Treaty of Independence with the Congo Republic gave them the right to stay there. But their presence is offensive to African nationalism and anti-colonialism. Elsewhere in the Congo, they fled in terror after the independence riots. But that picture has been changing, and the change has caused problems for the UN. Winston Burdett tells that story in a report from Leopoldville.
After their great exodus of last summer, the Belgians are coming back to the Congo, and we see them everywhere in Leopoldville these days. There are Belgians at the hotels again and in the bars and restaurants, Belgians mingling with Congolese at the cafe tables along the city's main boulevard, Belgians in the souvenir bazaar mixing with troops of the United Nations, men, women, and children. Entire families have returned and are still returning. The for sale signs have come down from abandoned shops and offices. Store after store in the main shopping center has reopened, and Belgians are back again behind the counter. And on Saturday morning, there's a rush of Belgian housewives at the supermarket. The automobiles that were evacuated across the river during last summer's riots have been ferried back again, and parking jams are again a familiar sight in the downtown business section. The returning Belgians have already recreated many familiar features of their social life in the city. The Belgian employees of various Belgian firms have recreated their traditional ball teams, and they are playing again on their traditional field, a main downtown street. While Congolese soldiers halt and wave away the traffic, and a mixed crowd of Belgian wives and children and Congolese youths watch the game. The country clubs have reopened, and there are crowds at the swimming pools every day of the week. Out in the residential quarter, Belgian families are beginning to move back again into their villas, where most of them have found their belongings just where they left them. There's been amazingly little looting. There's no reliable count on how many have come back, but every plane from Belgium, and there are several each week, is carrying a full load. These returning Belgians are of many kinds. Most of them are small colonists, people who have spent years in the Congo and whose livelihood and stake and roots are here. Some, perhaps, are coming back to liquidate their holdings, but many are hoping to stay. Then there are the employees of the various big Belgian monopolies, which control 90% of the Congo's economy and which export its great mineral and agricultural wealth. These company employees have enjoyed a living standard here which they cannot hope to match in Belgium. Finally, there are the Belgian officials, former civil servants who are coming back to serve now as technical advisors in the Congolese ministries. These officials are returning at the invitation of the Congolese government, independently of the UN and without consulting the UN. And their presence in key positions has set off a bitter quarrel here. The UN charges that these Belgian officials are not only refusing to cooperate with the UN, but are telling the Congolese not to cooperate. The Belgians undoubtedly influence the Congolese, but it's highly unlikely that they control them, and they are certainly in no position to run the country. The quarrel between the UN and the Belgians is not yet over. The Belgians are still coming in on their own, without bothering to channel their services through the United Nations. There's a mood of mutual suspicion and jealous rivalry for prestige and position.
The prestige and position of the United Nations have been on the downgrade in the Congo for months. The UN's early attempts to referee the struggle for power produced animosity from both sides, and the return of the Belgians has weakened its bargaining position. In the recent turns of the crisis, the UN has been weakened still further by a sharp reduction in numbers resulting from withdrawal of troops by some countries who joined the Russians in their attacks on Hammarskjöld's policies. One of the major withdrawals, this battalion-sized group from the African Republic of Guinea. The United Arab Republic followed suit, then Morocco, and Indonesia is now on the way out. These Guinea troops came to the Congo stripped for battle. They left loaded like tourists. The looting relatively restrained among the Congolese themselves, was so flagrant among these troops that a UN official says an investigation is underway. Cases of U.S. Army rations, refrigerators, furniture, presumably from houses vacated by Belgians. But with their departure, new problems for the UN. Dag Hammarskjöld says he needs 20,000 men to carry out his mandate. These withdrawals leave him with less than 15,000. And the UN force left on the scene is still suffering the effects of its touchy relations with the Congo government. It has been gradually forced into an isolation from which it may have trouble emerging. Again, Winston Burdett.
The atmosphere in Leopoldville is peculiarly unhappy. The Congolese accuse the UN of political favoritism and complain of UN arrogance. From the height of their skyscraper headquarters, UN officials accuse the Congolese of wanton irresponsibility and complain of Congolese childishness. There have been charges and countercharges. The Congolese, unable to settle their political quarrels themselves, accuse the UN of diabolic interference. The UN troops, which came here to maintain law and order, have been told that their primary duty, aside from maintaining lines of supply, is to protect their own UN personnel and UN installations. Their headquarters, their camps, their commissaries, their barracks, their depots and equipment. More and more, they live and work in isolation. There are no longer any joint UN-Congolese military patrols in the city or other signs of tangible cooperation. There is no UN program of military training or instruction. There are no officers' training courses, no program whatever to create an officers' corps for the Congolese army, about whose behavior the UN has complained so bitterly. UN officials have publicly described Colonel Mobutu's army as an undisciplined rabble. They have called Mobutu himself a military dictator, and, quite naturally, the Congolese don't like it.
The Congolese government of President Joseph Kasavubu, the only government which the United Nations recognizes, has freely expressed its dislike of the UN. President Kasavubu in an interview with correspondent Burdett.
Mr. Kasavubu, do you think that the United Nations organization in the Congo is fulfilling a useful or positive role?
I could not make a positive statement. Because account must be taken of many events which have given us a false conception of the United Nations and have hampered its usefulness. For instance, it began by ignoring all authority, and furthermore, it attempted to supersede the legal authority already established in the country. I am convinced that anywhere, in any country in the world, there is always an established authority, whatever its form. And regardless, in view of this existing authority, no outsider has the right to interpret from far away or to change the habits and customs in another country. And this is where the United Nations committed her little sin. I did not make much noise about it, but I tried to have those responsible understand that it was time to switch records and music, or at least that measures be taken to restore our confidence. Confidence is our paramount element. It does everything for us. When it is gone, it's just useless. Grand and beautiful things can be done. Castles in Spain can be erected. But all this means nothing to the people who want to be treated like any other human being, with all the dignity and respect due all beings.
The job of restoring Congolese confidence in the United Nations is not going to be easy, but it was set in motion this week here at the UN itself, with some help from an unexpected quarter from the United Arab Republic. Until this week, President Nasser's UAR government had been clearly playing Moscow's game, undermining confidence in the UN and furnishing aid to the rebel government of Moscow's man in the Congo, Antoine Gizenga. So it remains a puzzlement that the UAR, along with Ceylon and Liberia, sponsored that resolution which seemed to work directly contrary to Moscow's aims. The resolution does demand, as Moscow demands and the West had wished, complete Belgian withdrawal. It also calls for investigation of the Patrice Lumumba murder. But at the same time, it would also strengthen the UN role in the Congo by calling on it to use force, if necessary, to stop the civil war. Thus, it implies a vote of confidence in Dag Hammarskjöld. Moscow dared not vote against the small states, abstained instead, as did France, uneasy about questions of national sovereignty. But the resolution is not a solution, in spite of the vote. It is, at best, the ground rule for an armed truce which could create the atmosphere for a political truce. Through it all, the man at the UN perhaps most directly concerned was perhaps most silent. He was also voteless and unhappy. He's the man recognized as the only legal representative of the Congo government, and he is the subject of this report from Ernest Leiser.
A row house in Queens, the official residence of the Congo's ambassador designate to the UN, Gervais Bahizi, age 35, a family man. His family bonds are even tighter in a city and a country where he does not speak the language yet nor understand the ways. Mr. Bahizi lives in a pleasant middle-class neighborhood in New York's Jackson Heights section. So far, he says, he has had no contact at all with his white neighbors. He finds New York big, cold, impersonal. The subway is four blocks from his house. For him, no diplomatic limousine. This is his conveyance to the United Nations and to the UN mission that he heads. Mr. Bahizi hopes to buy a car soon, but he has found the formalities and the financing hard. Meantime, he has learned, despite the language barrier, to make his way to work on the E-train. In the great underground cavern of the New York subway, the Congo ambassador goes almost unnoticed. In the 4 months that Mr. Bahizi has been here, nobody has so much as spoken to him on the subway. But the ride, he says, at least gives him time to think. His subway stop, Lexington and 53rd. Another four blocks walk to his office through the bewildering maze of mid-Manhattan. Before the Belgians hurried his country to independence, Mr. Bahizi had a clerical job in the colonial government. Now he is the Congo's chief representative at the UN, but although he is accepted by the West, he is shunned by most of the other African delegates and by the communists. His place of work is a bare, three-room, converted apartment, manned at the moment by a Belgian consultant, a Swiss secretary, and four other Congolese. Only one of them is here permanently. He's the head of consular affairs. Mr. Bahizi's means of communication with Leopoldville, ordinary commercial teletype. It was over the teletype that he learned that his boss, Congo Prime Minister Eleo, had declared this week that he would resist the new Security Council resolution by force if need be. In his office, Mr. Bahizi took time out to tell me why the statement was made.
The reason Mr. Eleo issued the declaration he did is the fact that the Security Council has not taken into account the sovereignty of the independent state of the Congo.
Apparently, then you find that the United Nations is exceeding its mandate now. Is that correct?
Personally, I find that the UN wants to go farther still. The UN even has the intention of putting the Congo under its tutelage, something that the Congolese will never accept.
Well, do you think there's actually any possibility of a war between the Congolese troops and the troops of the United Nations if they try to enforce the Security Council resolution?
I think Mr. Hammarskjöld is intelligent enough to guide things in order to avoid any possible confrontation between armies. And I believe that he will proceed with consultations with us before carrying out what there needs to be done in the Congo.
Very simply, it appears that no one is completely satisfied with the current or the indicated course of events in the Congo. The major effect of the UN presence in the area has been to prevent the Congo from becoming a small battlefield for the big powers in the same way as Spain did in the mid-30s. Apart from the politics and the power struggle, there is still another necessary role for the United Nations. The Congo is a cause. For the major world powers, dominance there is a matter of vital necessity. Not that either side needs it, but neither can afford to let the other have it. For Belgium, its amputation means a whole new way of life, poorer and less self-sufficient than before. For the Congo's few educated natives, independence has set loose a blinding jealousy and lust for power. But the Congo is more than a cause. It is also people, and lost in the fight for supremacy is the human suffering that results. Least publicized of the UN activities is that concerned with the men, women, and children of the Congo. Here is Winston Burdett with Sture Linnaer, chief of the United Nations civilian operations in the Congo.
Is there any special phase of the United Nations civilian operation in the Congo which you think to be of particular importance at this time?
You might have heard of the refugee situation in the south of Kasai province, where there are actually 300,000 refugees, completely destitute. Under the normal food relief program of the United Nations, we have tried to channel as much as possible to that area, but it's now abundantly clear that the present supplies are not enough. I saw this kind of thing during the war in Greece, and I had hoped that I wouldn't see it again, but I can tell you, when you witness some 200 people literally dying in front of your eyes, it's not a thing you forget easily. Now, I think this brings out a point, and that is how easily you lose sight of the most important and vital problems, devoting too much time and attention to what I am inclined to term sometimes petty and superficial and sterile political squabbles. Here are people suffering, here are people dying. This is something we must all cooperate to alleviate. And if we put all our efforts behind this task, I'm sure we'll be able to cut through all the difficulties and really do something constructive. And after all, that's why we are here. The main reason for our coming to the Congo is to help the Congolese to help themselves and to assist this country in getting on the road to something really positive and constructive.
Helping people to help themselves, a simple enough objective, but before the UN can pursue that seemingly elementary goal, it has three big jobs in ending the chaos and anarchy of the Congo. First, emergency aid for the hundreds of thousands of ill and starving civilians. Second, the removal, or at least the neutralization, of the contestants, the big powers, former colonists, ambitious natives alike. And then, third and finally, the establishment of a peaceful order in which the Congolese at last can learn to govern themselves. This is the awesome burden which the UN, with new hope, took up this week. And you were there. An eyewitness to history. Your reporter, Walter Cronkite.